28 is where we're going to be. Matthew 28, the end of the chapter. If you're familiar with Matthew 28 and you see a missionary behind the podium, you probably have a pretty good idea where we're going this morning. I hope that as we look at this passage, you'll see some new things as we look at this passage. Many times we say we're familiar with the Great Commission, but there's really some incredible things around the Great Commission that I'd really like to focus on. We're going to, of course, look at the Great Commission, but the great commitments or the great promises that bookmark or bookend the Great Commission are pretty amazing. And sometimes our familiarity with a passage causes us to skip over things. I grew up in northern Illinois, as I said. And if you know anything about northern Illinois, it's a tad bit different than this region. I noticed you had some flat land as I was coming in. As soon as you got off 25, quite a bit of flat land. But in Rockford, Illinois, that region, there's nothing but flat land and corn. And it's rather boring once you see some of the mountains and things out here. And as a young person, I lived about 15 minutes outside of town. And so every day for school, I'd have to drive 15 minutes in, 15 minutes out, church, 15 minutes in, 15 minutes out. And so I saw a lot of flat land and a lot of corn and kind of thought that's what the world was. Until I had the privilege of spending a couple summers out here at the Wilds of the Rockies, which is, of course, no more. But, we're at about 10,000 feet, right on a beautiful lake, ridges, big valley, big mountain out in the distance. And so every morning I'm waking up, every night I'm going to bed, and I'm seeing this beautiful scene. And I'm pretty impressed coming from flatland, northern Illinois. And so every opportunity I have, I'm taking pictures, of the mountains, of the hills. Every little tourist trap has to be explored. Every mountain has to be climbed. Every little ridge has to be climbed. And, of course, once you climb one ridge, there's another ridge that's a little bit higher, so you have to go to that one, too. And, that was my life in between camp weeks when I had the opportunity. And so I was just struck by the beauty around me, the views and everything, right? And so I filled photo albums with books. This was before digital cameras, and so I was taking pictures left and right. And one of the things I noticed in the course of all that is that my friends who were from Colorado, who'd grown up in Denver or this area, weren't quite behaving with awe as I was behaving with awe at the scenes around them, right? Because they climbed Pikes Peak 10 times and they don't want to do it again. And, they had experienced all these things before. It was old news. They're used to waking up, looking out the door, and, yep, there's a bunch of mountains. Big deal, right? Maybe if I took them to the cornfields of northern Illinois, they would have been really impressed and been taking pictures and sprinting through the cornfields for experiences. And maybe not, right? But, right? Sometimes when we are used to something, we miss the beauty of it. And in this passage in particular, there's really two huge mountains sticking up out of the passage that are real easy to just kind of skim over because we're Christians. Maybe you've been in the church a long time. If every time a missionary comes through, he's referring to the Great Commission. If I asked you to memorize it or to quote it, a lot of you might be able to quote this passage. If I looked at your church documents, I have a hunch somewhere in there it would say we believe in evangelism, and you might even refer to the Great Commission. Some churches would say something like, we exist to make and mature disciples, to be like our Lord Jesus Christ, right? And they're often referencing a passage like this, because that's essentially what the passage is after. And all those things are true, and all those things are good. But what I want you to do is kind of take a step back as we look through this passage and think a little bit about what the Lord's saying and why he's saying it and how this applies to our lives. And I think you'll see some mountains here, or maybe you'll see cornfields if you're used to the mountains. And hopefully you'll be struck with some awe at what God is revealing about himself, what really Jesus is revealing about himself in this passage. But before we do that, I would like to push the rewind button and in our minds and move all the way back to the beginning of the Gospels and just think a little bit about Jesus' ministry. Because there's 27 and a half chapters right before we get here. A lot of things have been said, and it might be good for us to know kind of what the disciples are thinking, maybe, and what they've experienced as before Jesus says this, right? So let's do that. What do we know about Jesus, right? We've got four Gospels. Hopefully we know something. Many of us have probably read the Gospels, maybe once a year, maybe, right, number of times. What do we know? Well, think about his ministry. I mean, it's 3.5 years of really unparalleled, unbelievable ministry. As he would travel from place to place, enormous crowds would follow him. Do you remember the reaction of the crowds many times? I mean, thousands and thousands of people would be following him in not exactly a lush, green, flat land. If you've ever seen Palestine, it's rocky. It's lots of hills, lots of ravines, lots of valleys, little big hills. So people are following him in pretty adverse terrain. And there's no McDonald's, right? There's no, which I'm very familiar with now that I've been on deputation for a year and a half. If you want to know the McDonald's menu, ask me. Or the Burger King menu, because usually McDonald's, because they have play places. But anyway, all right? So these folks have been following him. And if you look at the scriptures, many, many times the people are often astonished, is the word that the Bible uses, or amazed at the things Jesus is saying. If you have a Bible program sometime, just type in astonished or amazed and look at the Gospels. Because numbers of times you will see that's what the people are experiencing. They're hearing the things Jesus is saying, and they are amazed at the way he's talking. He's not speaking like their scribes and their elders who are quoting this rabbi and this rabbi and Moses here and this rabbi. He's speaking instead with authority. And he's making it very clear who he is and what he thinks. And people are amazed at what he's doing. He combines that with an incredible, miraculous ministry. He walks into villages time after time, and everyone in the village who had a problem is healed. I mean, it says this many times. He'd walk into a village, anyone, epileptics, paralytics, people who were lame, people who were deaf, people who had never seen a thing, he healed. Now, when you do that kind of thing, you're going to have thousands of people following you, because everybody is going to want a piece of you. Everybody is going to want to see who is this person, especially in Palestine, where they're familiar with the great prophets and they've got the Old Testament and they're familiar with miracle workers to some extent, and they have read about them. Maybe they've never seen them. But now, especially by the time you get through all the Gospels, I mean, there must have been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who had been completely healed. For the first time in their very lives, probably had lived with some serious problem for maybe their entire life. Or maybe they'd been injured when they were a child. Remember, there weren't hospitals and an ambulance to pick you up and fix you and make you almost as good as new. You hurt yourself. Sorry, you're stuck like that. You get some disease as a kid, you got scars. You're gonna live with the consequences for the rest of your life until Jesus walks into your village. And everybody sees him up close, and everybody sees what he does, and everybody's shocked. You know, when Jesus raises a dead person out of a casket, think somebody might notice, right? And when he walks and sees Lazarus in the tomb 3 or 4 days after he's dead and has him come walking out, word will spread, right? The local television news in their van is pulling up with a satellite dish, and they're broadcasting, right? In their day and time, you know, obviously there wasn't a satellite and there wasn't a van, but there were people. And what were the people doing? Right? They were talking. I mean, everybody knew about this prophet within a short period of time. The word was spreading. He was very well known. His preaching was shocking. He was breaking the norms. He was doing things in an unorthodox way, at least what they were used to. A number of examples I could give. And this whole astonished and utterly astonished and amazed, as you look through the Gospels, was their often response. So Jesus is doing some very unusual things. As a matter of fact, if you look at the book of Matthew, especially after chapter 13, Jesus tends to speak in miracles and parables. Okay, in parables. What's a parable? Right, it's kind of a story, right? An earthly story, sometimes we say, with a heavenly meaning, or a story that has a point or 2 points, usually 1 point that he's making. And it's not all the stories of the or all the details of the story that are important. It's the point of the parable that's important. And so Jesus is often telling parables, especially after Matthew 13. And if you look closely at what Jesus is doing, he does something a little unusual. For example, I have a hunch that Pastor Unaru never does what Jesus did. Because what Jesus would do is tell a parable to the crowds. Here's this huge crowd. He would tell them a story. Then he would walk off in the corner into a room with his disciples. And the disciples would say, Jesus, what did that story mean? And Jesus would tell his disciples what the story meant. Does Pastor Renner ever do that? Does he ever get up here and tell you a great big story that's really neat and fascinating and interesting, and you know there's something to it? And then he walks over into the corner with his deacons and he says, now guys, let me tell you what I really meant. Right? He doesn't do that. Right? I don't do that. You generally know the point of what I'm saying. It's not a secret. Look at what Jesus is doing in the book of Matthew, especially after chapter 13. People are like, great story. many times. And they follow him. But he's not telling him the point. He's telling his disciples the point of what he's saying. So some unusual things are taking place, right? Amazing preaching. People are utterly astonished. A healing ministry that is unbelievable is following him and is a part of his ministry. And as we move through his life and as we move through what the scriptures reveal about him, obviously he's eventually arrested. There's a crucifixion. There's a resurrection. A little bit unusual, right? People are talking about this kind of thing, especially when something like this happens. Matthew 27 says, "Behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom." We're not talking about a tiny little, like a, you know, a little easy curtain that you rip. We're talking about a big, thick curtain that's enormous, that's in the temple where everybody sees it, especially the men on a regular basis and the priests. And when that thing gets ripped from top all the way down to bottom and people see directly into the Holy of Holies for the very first time, and they see what's the furniture that's inside the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant, and these different things, people are noticing. It continues. This is the end of Matthew 27. It says, "The veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks were split. The tombs were opened and many of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many." What happened there? How many of you ever experienced an earthquake? I've never experienced an earthquake, especially one where the rocks were split and the earth shook. But if that happened, I would remember it. And in addition, if a couple folks who I knew were in the cemetery showed up at church the next day, I would notice. You would notice. We would want to talk to them, wouldn't we? We'd be like, "Where you been? What happened? What did you see?" Right? We'd have a lot of questions for these folks. I mean, I'm sure there's a cemetery around here. Some of you have been to probably one of those cemeteries, and you know people in those cemeteries. And if you bumped into them at the grocery store or here at church or in your neighborhood, wow. Right? We'd have a lot of questions about it. So this is happening around the ministry of Jesus Christ. As a matter of fact, do you remember Cleopas? Where was Cleopas going? He was on the road to Emmaus. Okay, Cleopas is walking along the road to Emmaus with his friend. And they're talking about this great Hebrew prophet who had an unbelievable preaching ministry, who was doing miracles and performing miracles in unbelievable ways. He was raising people from the dead. They were hoping he was the Messiah, that he was this one that they had been looking for. And if you remember the story in Luke 24, Jesus joins them hiding his identity, right? And Jesus basically asks them, "So guys, what's going on? Or what's the news?" Cleopas turns to him, direct quote, Luke 24:18. He says, "One of them, named Cleopas, answered and said to him, 'Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem and unaware of the things which have happened here in these days?'" What's Cleopas saying to Jesus, who he does not recognize? He's saying, "What planet have you been on?" Right? Because everybody in this region knows exactly what's been happening. Everybody knows about this great Hebrew prophet who was doing all these unbelievable miracles, who had an unbelievable preaching ministry, who traversed up and down the countryside, went into every village. There was this enormous controversy in the city right around this in Passover. You know, the biggest festival for the Jewish people. He's crucified. People are saying he's dead, but now we're hearing he's risen from the dead. Right? Cleopas is like, everybody knows what's going on in the world right now. Where have you been? So just imagine, this is spread. This is what people are thinking. This is what's taking place before we get to Matthew 28. It's an unusual time, and it's really a sublime spectacle as we look at this passage where we're going to see the risen Christ without money. He's not offering these disciples anything. He doesn't have a big army standing behind him saying, "You're going to do what I said or else." He's talking to a bunch of nobodies. He's talking to a bunch of peasants who you have never heard of, by and large, except maybe for the apostles. I mean, I believe there's a lot more than just the 11 apostles or disciples here. There's probably quite a few more, and I'll explain why in a minute. But he's speaking to these folks, and he's about ready to say this, what we're about ready to read, all right? So all that has been taking place. So let's look now at what he's going to say. Matthew 28, verses 16 through 20. It says, "Then the 11 disciples went away into Galilee, into a mountain where Jesus had appointed them. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Jesus came and spake unto them, saying, 'All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. Based on that, go ye therefore, and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you, and lo, or behold, or pay attention, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. Amen. All right, let's back up a little bit. Verse 16. Let's start from the top. 11 disciples. 1 Corinthians, I think it's 14. 1 Corinthians 14 refers to a time when, or 1 Corinthians 15 refers to a time when Jesus appeared to over 500 of his disciples. Okay, it says he did that, but we find the actual historical event nowhere in the Gospels. And so maybe this event, maybe not. But I think there are probably more than 11 disciples here, because Jesus has already appeared to these 11 disciples numerous times. He spent a lot of time with them, 40 days, some quality time with them. He's now appearing to at least the 11 at the top of this little hill, this mountain. It's really a large hill in Palestine. And some of them have different reactions to Jesus, right? Because if you look at verse 17, it says, when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. I find it really difficult to believe that one of the 11 disciples, who spent 3 years we've just talked about, have seen him in his resurrected body a number of times, have heard from him, have learned from him, are still not real sure who Jesus is. They're doubtful about who he is, what he said he is. So I think there's a few other folks here. But I do want you to catch the point that there are some doubtful people here. I mean, think about what Jesus is thinking. Okay, if you're Jesus, and you've just done everything we've described, you are at the end of your ministry, you're about ready to give him the Great Commission, and you've got a bunch of disciples on this mountaintop looking at you, and you've got some of them who aren't very sure who you are, what are you thinking? What are you going to do if you're Jesus? I mean, I'm thinking about calling fire from heaven right about now, right? For the doubtful ones, because what else could I do? I've risen from the dead. Is there anything else that I could have done to impress you, to cause you to believe? I mean, Jesus has got an unbelievable ministry, and he still has doubting disciples at this stage of the ministry. And it's easy, I think, for us maybe to criticize and to point our fingers and say, wow, you guys had some big problems, right, to be at that stage of things. But I wonder if we don't really understand ourselves if we think that way. I mean, that's how I would naturally think. But if you think about yourself and you think about the scriptures you've had and the Holy Spirit living within you, and many of you probably grew up in Christian homes, you've memorized much of the scriptures, you have unbelievable opportunities in this country to surround yourselves with the scriptures and with the hearing and with preaching and with memorizing. And yet every single time we choose to sin, which for all of us probably is daily, we're saying to God, I know this is true. I've said I believe this, but right now I'm going to tell you that I really don't believe I will be held accountable for this. Or I know you said I shouldn't do this, but I want to do this right now, and I really am not going to take you at your word and do what I want to do. I'm going to lose my temper. I'm going to fill in the blank. Maybe something much worse. And so we're doubting that he really is going to hold us accountable, that he really is going to judge us, that he really is going to hold us responsible for our sin. So maybe we're not that different, I guess, is what I'm saying, from some of these disciples. And as we move into this passage, I hope it will be one where you kind of put yourself in those shoes. Because Jesus is, I think, in some ways speaking to both groups of disciples. He's speaking to the doubtful, and he's speaking to the believing in what he says in these next few verses. Because it says in verse 18, and Jesus came and spake unto them. So get the picture. Jesus is at the top of the hill. He's looking down. Disciples are working their way up. They see him. Some recognize who he is. And what do? If you're an Old Testament Jew and you realize that person in the flesh is Jesus, the Son of God, who is actually God the Father, right? Because the Trinity, they're recognizing these things. They're seeing it. They realize he is Yahweh. What are you going to do? You're going to run up there and give him a high five? You're going to give him a buddy hug? Glad to see you, Jesus? Or are you going to hit your face and worship right there, right? When Jews worship, right, they're probably on their knees, maybe on their face. They know who he is. Some of them aren't so sure, so they're kind of looking at him like, well, that kind of looks like Jesus from here. You know, is he really who he says he is? So what does Jesus do? Verse 18, it says, Jesus came and spake to them. So Jesus moves down the hill, gets nice and close so they can see the white of his eyes and say, yep, that's him. Maybe he even shows them the scars. Okay, that's definitely Jesus. Nice and close. And what does he say to them? The end of verse 18, he says, all power is given unto me in heaven and earth. One of the great commitments of the Great Commission, the first one. What does that mean? When Jesus says, all power, all authority is given unto me in heaven and in earth, what is he saying? He's saying what? All authority. I mean, none of these are $10 words, right? All generally means everything, right? All. There's not a whole lot of other ways to define that. All power, all authority, and everything up there and everything down here belongs to me. That's what Jesus is saying. Do we believe that? I mean, do you really believe that? I mean, when you wreck your car, right? When you run into the other car, when you get fired from your job, when the national economy goes this way, when you have some problem in your family, when you get that disease, when you break your leg, when circumstances don't go like you think they should go, do you really believe this passage? Because I'll know if I'm hanging out with you. Because all I got to do is watch your response. The way you respond to the circumstances that come into your life tells me, and everybody else, if you believe that Jesus Christ is completely sovereign over everything up there and everything down here. Do you really believe that? Because if you know, he's not saying this on accident. He didn't just decide, well, I got all these disciples here. I'm just going to remind them that I am in complete control of everything, right? He's got a bunch of disciples who are, some are believing, some are doubtful. They're standing here on this mountaintop, and he's about ready to give them verses 19 and 20, and he wants them to know, be real certain about the very fact that he is completely sovereign over everything that happens up there and everything that happens down there. So that should be a big encouragement to those doubting disciples, right? So then he moves then into the Great Commission, which we're familiar with, verse 19. Now, the Great Commission, we're familiar with, as I said. There's four words in there that kind of look like verbs. What's a verb? Right? It's an action word, right? I said they look like verbs. There's actually three of them that are a participle. Now, I know I just used like Greek language and I totally lost half the congregation when I said that. But let me briefly explain that there's three participles and one main verb. In other words, the one main verb is the main action, the main idea of the big sentence. Okay? So there's one thing Jesus is saying in a command. This is what you're doing. There's other three things that are participles that modify, clarify, or explain the main verb. So Jesus is saying, and all of these things look like commands because the main verb is a command. So he's saying, this is the main thing, and you're going to do this with these other things. I'm going to explain what I mean here by these things. Did I lose you? Anybody still sleeping? Hopefully you're with me there, right? So what do you think the main verb in this passage is? You know, that's not the main verb. That's generally what a lot of people think. So you're not unusual in that, okay? You're not alone in that if you're in that camp. It's actually the second word. You know what the second word is? Second word there is teach, right? There's go, teach, baptize, teach. Second one is actually teach. In my King James Version, there's a little letter I by the word teach, which means look in your margin because I got something else to tell you. And when I look in my margin, it says, or make disciples. So what Jesus is saying, first of all, is go. But he's really saying that as a participle. Obviously, none of us know Greek, so none of us can tell that without looking at the Greek. And it says, so what Jesus is saying is, as you're going through life, make disciples of all the nations. And you do that by baptizing them, which means you've got to be part of a local church because you're not baptizing in your bathtub, you're baptizing up here. And the rest of the local church needs to see that. And so you're baptizing them and you're teaching them everything that I've ever told you. That's what the Great Commission is. It's making disciples of all the nations. So, if that's true, what have we just said? We've just said Jesus spent 3.5 years of his ministry doing unbelievable things, brought them everybody to a mountaintop, gave them this command for the very first time, that they should now go to not just the little nation of Israel, but to all the nations and make disciples of them, baptize them, teach them everything he's ever said. That's what he's saying to them. And I have a hunch, if I'd walked in here this morning and had not preached this message and walked up to you and said, do you believe in the Great Commission? Pretty much all of you, if you know about it, would have said, yeah, sure. Of course, can't be a Christian and not believe that, right? I mean, that's like foundational to being a Christian. If you know very many things as a Christian, one of them is that we believe in evangelizing. We believe in witnessing to other folks. We believe in telling them about Jesus Christ. So the question then becomes, if you claim to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, Jesus has this enormous command at the end of his ministry, after doing all these things, commissioning his disciples, that says, make disciples of all the nations. You've got a life in 2010, right? 2010. Just think like this way, right? Just to be thinking about, here's the command, here's your life. If I had to give you 3 seconds to summarize your life in your head, do it, all right? Let's just think, what's your life about? 3 seconds. Okay? Does the Great Commission, making disciples of all the nations, and your life ever intersect? In other words, if I was to come to you and say, in the last year, when did you attempt to take a heathen, a pagan, an unbeliever, somebody who's not a disciple of Jesus Christ, when did you try to make a disciple of that person? Now, obviously, that takes a million different forms, right? It could be a tract. It could be a word. It could be spending a few minutes in prayer with an unbeliever. It could be giving them a tape. It could be inviting them to a service where they'll hear the word of God. It could be, right? It could be anything. It could be expressing appreciation and concern and love across the fence to somebody who doesn't know Jesus, and you're taking effort, you're taking opportunities to inject the gospel somehow, or why you're different, or why you do what you do, into the conversation. You know, unbelievers are pretty quick, right? They know you're different. If you work with them and you have a Christian testimony, they know you're different. They know you don't cuss up a storm at every opportunity. They know you do what you do because you're not trying to please men, you're trying to please God. And that's noticeable. Never forget, I was working in a factory, third shift, 11 p.m. to 6, 7 a.m. in the Chicago area. Not a lot of fun. Out of undergrad, so I got my pre-law degree, and I'm working in a vacuum furnace factory all night. And, you know, the guys who tend to work 11 to 6 p.m. all night in the Chicago area tend not to be the cream of the crop. They tend to be very vile, pagan guys who don't have a lot of skills. But they do have a little bit of money. And you know what they do with that money? They get drunk. They sleep around. They entertain themselves to death. And then they come to work where they're miserable for 6 or 7 hours. And the things that come out of their mouths tend not to be very edifying in the course of all that. And they tend to notice when you don't act like them. So, I mean, it took like one guy in particular who had kind of grown up in a Christian home. He cornered me one day. And he wasn't really living as a believer. He cornered me and he said, "Who are you? Where'd you come from? Where'd you go to school? Where do you go to church?" He had all these questions because he had been exposed a little bit to Christianity. He knew that I wasn't like them, even though I was not Mr. Super Spirituality by any means, right? But he knew I wasn't cussing up a storm. He knew I wasn't living like them. He knew there were reasons for that. And if you have any kind of relationships with unbelievers, which I hope you do, then they're going to know. They're going to notice. And you're going to have opportunities to speak truth, to help make a disciple of Jesus Christ. Now, some of you might think, well, I take care of 3 children all day and all night, and I don't have a lot of opportunities. Well, may I remind you that little children, like from 4 weeks old to, I mean, before that even, but little children are pagans. Okay? They're heathen. I have 3 of them. You know, I never had to teach my 6-year-old when she was like 2 years old to say no. My 2.5-year-old, my 3.5-year-old now, says no all the time. I call her Dr. No because it doesn't matter what I ask her. She says no. And she's got a poochie lip. She's just ornery, just plain ornery. Maybe you have one like that. I don't know what happened there with the genes, but somehow we got an ornery one. And she is an unbeliever. She is a pagan. She is a heathen. And all 3 of them are like that. Our year and a half-year-old, no, don't do that. Did I have to train her to do that? Did I have to teach her to say no? Did I have to teach her to deceptively disobey before they can talk? Uh-uh. Right? There are unbelievers, mothers, all around us. We have opportunities to make disciples of Jesus Christ. The question is, do we believe it and are we doing it? And I could spend a lot of time talking about what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. And, you know, in our day and age, people think I put a WWG bracelet on and I show up to church on a Sunday morning and I put a little money in the plate and shazam, I'm a disciple of Jesus Christ. Yeah, Jesus said things like, if you don't take up your cross and follow me, you're not my disciple. If you're not willing to give up your mother and your father and your brother and your sister and everything you possess and everything you own and every relationship you hold dear for me, you cannot be my disciple. Remember, for first century Jew, was the cross a piece of jewelry they wore? Was the cross something they put used as decoration in a church building? No. The cross was the most painful way for the longest amount of time the Romans and the Persians could get somebody to die. Right? Because they sat around saying, how can we torture people? How can we kill people but make them suffer for an enormous amount of time? Oh, the cross. Yeah. Let's beat somebody up. Let's nail them to a couple pieces of wood. Let's stick them in the community before their entire family, without any clothing on, after we've beat them up, nailed them to this cross. Let's leave them up there until they die, which usually takes many, many days, sometimes longer. As a matter of fact, usually somebody on a cross didn't die from being nailed to the wood. They died because their lungs filled with bodily fluid, and they suffocated. And if they really got tired of looking at you, you know, day after day, week after week, they'd just come by with a big hammer and break your legs to get you to die quicker. Okay, so when Jesus says, if you're not willing to take up your cross and follow me, you can't be my disciple. Is that what you think a disciple is in 2010? Is that the level of commitment you think Jesus is asking of you? Because nothing's changed. Those are still the words that are there, that they're hearing, that we should be hearing today. That's what Jesus expects. Those are the kind of disciples Jesus wants and requires. They're the kind of disciples we need to be making as missionaries. Whether you're a missionary in Greeley or you're a missionary in Kenya, or you pick your country, right? Because this passage here doesn't just apply to Pastor Unruh or to the deacons or to the Mr. Missionary. It applies to everybody who calls themselves a disciple of Jesus Christ. Right? Heavy words, heavy words. Jesus says these things in the Great Commission. He then moves into this last great commitment or this last great promise. And he says to us, I am with you always, even to the end of the world. All right. Again, no $10 words in that little sentence, is there? What does that mean? I am with you always, even unto the end of the world or the end of the age. Well, as far as I can tell, we're all still here. Right? This is still the world. This is real. This is not pretend, despite what some philosophers might say. Okay? So I'm here, and Jesus says, I am with you always. So what does that mean? Does that mean when I go home today at lunch that he's there? Does that mean at work he's there? Does that mean when I sleep he's there? Does that mean if I get on a little airplane and I fly way over there that he's there? Does that mean when I'm sinning he's there? Yeah, right? That's what it means. It means no matter what, no matter where I go, no matter how high, no matter how low, no matter how far in the sea, no matter how far to the east, no matter how far to the west, he's there. I am with you always, even to the end of the world. The question really is, now that we understand it, which we of course did before, but do you believe it? Because if you really believe that Jesus is all-powerful and that Jesus is omnipresent, right, that he is always present, that will affect your life. That will affect the way you live, especially when he drops the bomb, the Great Commission, right in the middle of those two statements. And these are just like two huge mountains sticking up out of this passage. Jesus says to these doubting and believing disciples, I am all powerful. I have everything under control. And I am always present. No matter where you go, no matter what you do, I am always with you. You think Jesus said those things around the Great Commission because he didn't have anything else to say? Or do you think he said those things because those disciples needed to hear what we need to hear when he tells us to do something like that? We needed to hear that, didn't we? Because if we're going to try to be the kind of disciples Jesus wants us to be, we need to know that he's got everything under control. And there's nothing I can do. There's no circumstance I can get into where there's a couple maverick molecules running around that he can say, oh, sorry about that. I wasn't paying attention when that happened. Whoops, I was taking a nap. Sorry. You know, I need a vacation every now and then. I got at least 7 days a year where I can't monitor your life. Is he saying that? No, he's not saying that. Is he? He is the all-sovereign creator who is all-powerful. He's given us a job to do. Doesn't matter who you are, where you are, if you claim to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, you qualify. And he says these things. If you look at the lives of the early disciples, I think they believed this. If for no other reason, we're sitting in Greeley, Colorado, 2,000 years after a bunch of nobodies heard that. There's like, I don't know, 70 people here? I don't know how many. I can't count big groups very well, but there's a lot of people out in, 2,000 years ago, there was a whole lot of nothing here, right? A bunch of animals maybe running around. Here we are, a bunch of people, old, young, 2,000 years after Jesus said this for the very first time. Because somebody must have believed what he said. And a couple continents away on the other side of the earth, you and I are sitting here saying we believe these things. Somebody's been faithful, haven't they? Somebody believed what Jesus said. You know, there weren't any Harvard grads back here, right? There weren't any Princeton grads. There are a bunch of people with very little training, very little education. But they believed what Jesus said, and they did their best, as Jesus had taught them, and as he commanded them to make disciples of all the nations. And you and I sit here today because of it. It's kind of amazing when you think about it. The real question, I guess, for some of us might be, in 150 years, if Joe Schmo pulls into Greeley, are they going to be able to say, wow, there's some Christians here? And are some of those Christians going to be able to point at you, right, or your congregation and say, it was those folks over there. Somebody told me about Christ, and they discipled me, and I discipled my children, and that's how I got here. Wouldn't that be a tremendous testimony for this church? If you look at Paul's ministry, 2 Corinthians 11. I'll just read it. Don't take time to look at it. 2 Corinthians 11. It says, this is Paul describing his life. 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Now, okay, back up. 5 times I was beaten with lashes. 39 times. 39, 39, 39, 39, 39. Right? The second time he's getting the lashes, they know he's been there before because he's got scars. Third time, fourth time, fifth time, 39 lashes. For trying to make disciples of Jesus Christ. You know, remember, he wasn't checked into the hospital, pumped with antibiotics, and fed Jell-O on his stomach for a couple weeks till he healed. Right? I mean, he suffered. 3 times, he was beaten with rods. Once, I was stoned, and it wasn't gravel from the parking lot. Right? It was big rocks aimed at his head to kill him as quickly as possible. He says, a night and a day I've spent in the deep. I've been in frequent journeys, dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from countrymen, dangers from Gentiles, from the city, from the wilderness, on the sea, among false brethren. I've been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights and hunger and thirst, often without food and cold and exposure. What are you like without food, water, sleep, in a miserable condition where it's, you know, very cold or something? You're not real fun to be around, are you? Me neither. It's pretty ugly. When my three-year-old, about a week ago, all three of our kids were puking in the middle of the night. Not a good thing, right? And that means I'm not getting sleep, which is another bad thing, right? And so maybe the next day I'm not Mr. Congeniality. Paul's living like this all the time. Why is he doing that? You've got to be crazy to live a life like that, don't you? Does that make any sense whatsoever to have a life like Paul has? And today, think about it. I mean, the second time I get the 39 lashes, I've got a new calling. Right? Maybe the ministry isn't for me. Okay. You don't act like that. You don't, like all the disciples, you don't go into the Colosseum before wild animals and fight them unless you believe that all power is given unto him in heaven and in earth, and you believe that I'm with you always, even unto the end of the world or the end of my life. See, if you believe those two things, is there anything that you can't do? I mean, there's certainly a whole lot of more truth. You know, that God's doing all things for his glory and for our good. And there's so many other passages we could look at that give us lots of other motivations. But, right? I mean, if he is all powerful and he is always present, the things he asks me to do are not that difficult. Yeah, they're hard sometimes. Yeah, they're difficult sometimes. But he's a great God. He's in complete control. He's given us the Great Commission. And it doesn't apply just to me. It applies to you. It applies to you and your neighbor across the street and the friends and the relatives and the relationships you have. And I think it would be a tremendous thing if in 100 years, in 50 years, people could look back at this church and say, there were people there who shared Christ with me, who made a disciple of me in some way. Wouldn't that be a tremendous thing? Let's pray that we'd all be faithful. I'm going to close in a word of prayer, and then, Pastor, if you'd come. Father, we